70 years ago, Jim Lovell was flying a nighttime training mission over the Gulf of Japan. When a storm blew in, he was ordered back to his ship, but on the way, his radio and his instrument panel malfunctioned and went out. He was traveling without any light or any means of direct communication with the ship. Unable to see the horizon because of the storm clouds, and too embarrassed to send a rescue signal to his ship, which would require them to turn on their lights, which had been shut off because of their operating rules that they were going under at the time, he was lost and alone out there in the dark and didn't know what was going to happen. And just about the time he was about to lose all hope and maybe have to get over his embarrassment and actually send a signal saying that he was lost, he spotted something in the water. A trail of bioluminescent plankton showing on the ocean, because his plane was so dark and his eyes had adjusted to the dark, he noticed a trail of plankton lighting up the sea, and knowing that the only thing big enough to cause a trail of plankton like that to light up was his ship, he was able to change his course, follow that trail all the way back to his ship, and land safely on his aircraft carrier. We know Jim Lovell, Lieutenant Jim Lovell, as the pilot of the Apollo 13. He is the one that Tom Hanks played in the movie who brought that space capsule back safely to Earth, having learned in the past about not giving up hope and looking for answers and solutions wherever he could find them. Again, the only reason he could see that trail was because of his lights being out and it being so dark. It stood out and it showed itself to him on the ocean surface below him. Now, the way the plankton brought Lieutenant Lovell to safety explains why the church is a beacon. The church's reflective glow, caused by its connection to Christ, leads the lost to safety in Jesus Christ. Like that plankton, we are to be so stirred up by the movement of Christ in our lives that we become lights in the dark, leading people to safety in Him. And so tonight we're going to look again at our subject series, the Why the Church Is, and there's a reason for that. I'm preaching a gospel meeting at the Raised Branch Church in Bowling Green in a couple of weeks from today, and it's a series on why the church is, and they ask for a lesson on current culture and how the church is to deal with current culture. And the only way I can see the church being able to deal with current culture effectively is by being a beacon. And so that's the title of the lesson, Why the Church is a Beacon. And I can tell you already, this is going to be a two-part. We're only going to get through about half of it tonight, and we'll do the other half next week, and then a week later, I'll have to figure out a way to condense that down to a sermon that won't make everybody die after for being too long. But it shouldn't surprise us to learn that one of the points, or of perhaps the Lord's most famous lines in his most famous sermon, the Sermon on the Mount, is from Matthew chapter 5, verses 14 through 16, where it talks about being lights in the world. In Matthew chapter 5, verses 14 through 16, I asked you to open that a moment ago. Let's read there. Verse 14 says, "You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor does anyone light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven." But in order to understand that passage and the value of the church as lights in the world, we have to talk a little bit about darkness, and that's unfortunately going to take up most of our time tonight. We'll have a few things that we'll look at the end of class, or at the end of our study, to show how important it is that we become lights in the dark world. But let's talk a little bit about the darkness that is the world. The world is, like that dark night for Jim Lovell, filled with storm clouds of ungodliness. All around us there is chaos, confusion, and hopelessness as the forces of darkness are doing everything they can to deceive and destroy people's lives. We see it just exploding in today's culture wars as the so-called woke mob seeks to destroy all cultural traditions. Now, some of you are saying, well, whoa, what does that mean? You may have heard the word, but you don't know what it means, or you may have never even heard of it. And so we're going to talk about what woke is, what it means, and how we should respond to its cultural impact. But of course, to do that, we're going to have to define the word and explore its impact on culture. And then we'll discuss a little bit about how to respond at the end of this lesson, and then in more detail next Sunday night. The word woke originated about 100 years ago among black culture to warn black Americans to be awake and alert to the dangers they faced in the South during the height of segregation and the KKK activities. It was a dangerous time for them in the South. They had to be very careful. They had to be very aware of where they were and their circumstances and situations so that they could be aware of, try to remain safe. That phrase carried on through the civil rights movements of the 60s, but it was redefined, it was seized and redefined about around 2010 by gay activists and radical Marxists to include all fringe or marginalized groups. Anybody that believed themselves to be marginalized from normal American culture became automatically a part of the woke group and a part of their effort to seize power to gain control over society. And they have one goal in their life. They have one goal. And you need to understand what their one goal is. It is to destroy current cultural arrangements. It's not a matter of trying to fit in. It's a matter of wiping out what they don't like to replace it with themselves and what they consider or want to become normalized. Do not for one minute, please understand this, do not for one minute think that the woke groups, whatever title or name they call themselves by the way, don't worry about using the word woke, it's kind of become a pejorative anyway. So when you talk about just current culture, think about people who are trying to overturn it and how to deal with them. And as you think about how to deal with them, understand when they say they want equality, they don't mean that. In fact, they've actually become very bold and said that they're for diversity, equity, and inclusion. It used to be diversity and inclusion. When I was worked in the corporate world 15 years ago, I was on a diversity and inclusion committee. And I was one of the ones who was engaged in trying to make sure everybody was welcoming of people of different backgrounds into the company. I saw it and I dropped out of it because I saw that it was going toward becoming something more radical than that, and I didn't want to have anything to do with that. And so they have changed over time. Now it's diversity, equity, and inclusion. Well, what is equity? Equity is the idea of equal distribution. It's not equal opportunity. Equality is you and I stand before the law the same, and we stand before society as the same, and we rise or fall on our own talents. For them, it's the idea of, I don't care what your talents are, I want to receive the same prize that you received. That's equity. That's where they're going with it. They will take what they want from whomever they want, however they can. That's why you saw all the mobs marching and going crazy for the last few years and going through towns and tearing things up and destroying things and going through cities and just cleaning out like locusts all the stores on the major streets where there were the retail stores. They were just taking whatever they wanted. They were demonstrating that they had the power to take what they wanted. And so what they think of themselves is that they think of themselves, and they want to be thought of, though, as the modern version of Robin Hood. You know who Robin Hood is? The old English fable about the guy who would steal from the rich and give to the poor because the rich were evil and cruel and all those kind of things. That's how they want to be seen. But what they are is they are the modern version of the communist dictators of the 20th century who killed hundreds of millions of people. That's what we're dealing with. And we have to understand that's who we're dealing with and recognize that behind all the rhetoric, behind all the talk, they want to take what they can and they do not care who gets hurt in the process. And so woke now means the politics of anger and resentment. And they are pushing for the radical redistribution of what they consider power and wealth. If you are elected official and you're not one of their fringe groups, you've got to go so they can get one of their fringe group people in there. It's a large collection of angry, resentful, envious people aligning in opposition to those that they believe took all their stuff, and they want it back. That's their mindset. That's their thinking. And if they can't get it back, understand this as well. If they can't get it back, in other words, if you don't hand it over to them voluntarily, they're going to take it from you. And if they can't take it from you, they're going to burn it to the ground. That's how horrifically evil they are in their thinking. Now, not most of them that are involved in it don't understand that, but the leaders are understanding it, and they're using the mob who thinks that they're trying to be the Robin Hood to destroy and take and destroy. That's what we're dealing with. That's why the traditional male-female marriage relationship has to be destroyed. That's what they're trying to do. They have to destroy it so that marriage can be whatever they want it to be. Whoever, whomever can marry whomever or whatever they want to marry and consider as their spouse. Traditional male-female marriage relationship's got to go. And if you wonder where all this gender dysphoria is coming from and all this mess about am I male, am I female, am I they male, they whatever I might be, what pronoun do I accept or claim for myself? That arises out of their desire to destroy male-female biological distinctions. That's where all of this is coming from. They're trying to destroy that distinction so that they can be whomever they want, whenever they want, and nobody can say anything about it. In fact, not only can you not say anything against it, you're supposed to support it and encourage it and celebrate it. That's what this woke crowd is all about. And listen to this. They do not care how many children's lives they destroy along the way. They don't care. And what they're finding out now is more and more of these folks that are who are going through the transition of switching from what they were born as to what they think they should be, their mental health problems are just off the chart, and they're finding out that it's a disaster. Psychologically, not just morally, but psychologically. And the society is becoming more and more entrenched in supporting and encouraging that. I retired from my previous job in 2015, corporate job in 2015. About 6 to 8 months before I retired, I was pleased the fact that I was retiring. Because the manager, the general manager of the entire corporation, or that division of the corporation, a $1 billion division, was furious and hammered the entire corporation because of an event that happened in California. There was a manager of a California office who had a 9-year-old son. This 9-year-old son decided that he was a she. And this manager was accepting and endorsing and approving of that, so much so that they were having him take the drugs to alter his chemical balance, and were considering and working toward a surgical transition from male to female. It's child abuse. That is child abuse by definition. But our culture is glorifying that. This woke culture is saying, you have to accept that, honor it, respect it, glorify it. And so this guy was doing this, and he put up some posters celebrating his son's transition from a boy to a girl in their office, and somebody got upset about it because one of the posters was across from his or her desk. I never got all the details, but moved the poster. And you would have thought they had gone out and kicked somebody's puppy or beat somebody's kid. Nowadays, people would get more upset about kicking a puppy. That's how off balance our culture is done. And this director of the entire corporation, or this division of the corporation, came out on the side of the manager, condemned anybody who was opposed to it, and had the audacity to either say anything or even do anything about it. That was 10 years ago. It's only gotten worse. And it's only going to get worse. They are the ultimate hedonists. Hedonist is somebody who just wants what they want, when they want it. They don't care who gets hurt in the process. They want immediate gratification, and they want everyone else's toy now. If you have a toy, they want it, and they want it now. And like that selfish child who was playing with that toy, they will destroy the toy before letting somebody else play with it. That's what we're dealing with. People who just want to watch the forest burn because they don't like what's in it. Now, one of the mistakes we can make, well, there are two big mistakes we can make. One is to attack it viciously with anger and hatred and resentment. That's just becoming like them. But the other one is to think that this is new, that this is something that's never happened before in the history of the world. Can I take you to a passage in the Bible that demonstrates this spirit and this attitude all the way back in Genesis chapter 4? Turn, if you will, to Genesis chapter 4 and the story of Cain and Abel. Now, we had a sermon about this a while back, but I just want us to look at this point here of Cain and Abel. What Cain was is Cain was the ultimate or the earliest recorded hedonist. He was the earliest person recorded who was determined to have what he wanted, when he wanted, his way, and if he didn't get it, he would destroy whatever he felt he could that was interfering with his right to have what he wanted. In verse 2, it says, this is Genesis chapter 4, verse 2. They've given birth to Cain and Abel. And it says in verse 2, and Abel was a keeper of flocks, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. So it came about in the course of time that Cain brought an offering to the Lord of the fruit of the ground. Abel, on his part, also brought of the firstlings of his flock and of their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and for his offering, but for Cain and for his offering he had no regard. So Cain was the one who would be considered an outsider. He was the one on the fringe. He was the one that was excluded because he didn't do it the way God required him. He didn't do what God wanted. His attitude was bad and he brought the wrong stuff. He didn't care about what God wanted. He was bringing what he wanted and the way he wanted to do it. And so when God says, no, that's not accepted, I will not accept what you've brought. I'll accept what Abel brought, because Abel brought it by faith, as we saw in Hebrews chapter 11. But what you brought, I will not accept. And because he said he would not accept it, notice in verse 5, so Cain became very angry and his countenance fell. Anger and resentment. He was angry at God for not accepting what he wanted, and he was angry and of his brother and resentful of his brother for his offer being accepted. So he was the ultimate hedonist. He was the ultimate one who had to have things his way. Verse 6, then the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? And why has your countenance fallen? So what he's doing is, and this is the way we need to approach this and be something for next week, he's saying to him, what are you upset about? Why is this making you angry? Why has this upset you? Why are you so resentful? And verse 7, he gets to the heart of it. If you do well. In other words, if you do what is right, if you do what I call for, will not your countenance be lifted up? In other words, won't you be accepted? You won't be now marginalized. You will now be accepted. And that's all that he was wanting, is to be accepted, but he didn't want to be accepted on God's terms. And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door and its desire is for you, but you must master it. The spirit of anger and resentment will master you. It will take you over. It will control you. If you give in to it, it will consume you. And then you will try to consume anything that is causing that. And that's exactly what we're seeing in our culture and in our society today. He, like any 3-year-old who didn't get what he wanted because his other 3-year-old friend was playing with it, decided that if he could not have God's approval, then Abel wasn't going to get it either, and so he killed him. Folks, that's exactly what's going on in our society today. You stand in front of the mob, try to stop this mob, they will kill you. Maybe even physically, depending on the situation, but they will try to kill your reputation. They will try to destroy your job. They will get you fired. They will get you shut down. They will get you deplatformed, which is you'll get kicked off of YouTube or Facebook because you said something they didn't approve of. It'll be like my cousin. I have a cousin that is a practicing homosexual who got furious at me over an article I wrote on Facebook last year. and called me all kinds of names. But interestingly enough, he didn't unfriend me. So I responded and I keep posting. And I hadn't been the recipient of his vitriol and since then. But you know what? That was thousands of years ago. 2,000 years ago, it was happening to Jesus. Turn, if you will, into the New Testament, to Mark chapter 15. In Mark chapter 15 and verse 10, it's just boldly stated by Mark that the reason that the Jews delivered Jesus to the Roman power was envy. They were driven by envy. This is Mark chapter 15 and verse 10. And the leader of the Jewish of the Roman occupation force, Pilate, knew it. Verse 10. For he was aware, it's talking about Pilate, that the chief priests had handed him over because of envy. So the Lord was being treated that way because of envy. Bitter resentment and envy of his power and his influence caused the Jewish rulers to get him killed. Just like Cain killed his brother Abel. And guess what? In John chapter 15, Jesus said that his followers, you and me, will face the same kind of persecution, the same kind of hatred. John chapter 15, and then verses 18 and 19. If the world hates you, you know that it has hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love its own, but because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, because of this, the world hates you. One of the takeaways we should bring with that is a simple fact that if we are of Christ, if we are followers of Christ, we're going to speak and live in a way that the world is going to hate us. They're not going to tolerate us. They're not going to put up with us. They're not going to appreciate or honor or celebrate our beliefs. They're going to do everything they can to destroy it. It's been that way since Christ came. It's been that way since before Christ, going all the way back to Cain. This hatred has been poured out on the believers in Christ for 2,000 years. So the point from this is, don't make the mistake of thinking, oh, this is just nothing like this. It's never been anything like this. Maybe not in our lifetime and in our society and where we're living. But this way of life, this hatred of God has been around for centuries, and it has been a part of brethren even here in America in many ways as well. Maybe not as violent, but just as strong. Hatred that is just as strong. Well, I think we talked about darkness long enough. Yeah, I think so. I think so. And we don't have a whole lot of time, but let's just talk for a few moments about light. Let's just change from talking about light, or darkness, to light. Going back to Matthew chapter 5, it should not surprise us that Jesus called on us to be reflections of Him, to shine in the world so that they can see Him through us, through our lives. And this concept is repeated throughout the New Testament in a number of other passages, but again, just wanted to bring our attention back to that one. Think of it this way. Light has been a symbol of holiness, goodness, knowledge, wisdom, grace, hope, and revelation ever since creation, going back to creation in Genesis chapter 1. The first thing that God created was light. And the light dispelled the darkness, and the light was not overcome by the darkness, and the light was good. God saw the light and saw that it was good. And so this is the beginning of the power of light to change things. And so God is using light as that symbol. And this light, of course, is in opposition to or contrast with darkness that represents everything that is opposed to God. Turn over to John chapter 1. We see there that John referred to Jesus as the one, as the light sent into the world. John chapter 1, verses 1 through 5. It says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through Him, and apart from Him, nothing came into being that has come into being. In Him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it or overcome it." And so this light that is Jesus came into the world, and the darkness that is the world, even though it killed Him, even though it put Him to death, could not keep Him dead, because It had no power over him. And he overcame it. Verse 9, there was the true light that came in, that which coming into the world enlightens every man. And so Jesus is the light of the world. In fact, that's what Jesus called himself later in John chapters 8 and 9. Look in chapter 8, verses 20, or verse 12. Jesus said, I am the light of the world. He who follows me will not walk in the darkness, but will have the light of life. And then in chapter 9, or then again in chapter 9, and in verse 5, he says, While I am in the world, I am the light of the world. And so Jesus is the light. In the middle of all this darkness, you have this blaring light, greater than the sun, more powerful than the sun, shining out and saying, the world will not overcome me. The world will not destroy him. He is the light of the earth, the light of the world. And so we have that to look to. So whenever it looks dark and it looks bleak and it looks like there's no hope, look for the light. Look for his people that will show you the light, will show you the power of God to win over these things, to defeat sin and defeat the culture of the world. And then also in John 8, Jesus makes it clear that his light is moral light. Moral light, spiritual light, that is more powerful than the sun. That's greater than the sun, has eternal power. The sun will burn up, the sun will be destroyed. But the moral light that is Jesus will never end, will never be destroyed. And so the sunlight that we see outside today is just a pale shadow and symbol of the light. In John chapter 8, look in verses 23 and 24. He says, you're from below, I am from above, you are of this world, I am not over. That is not the passage I wanted. How did I mess that up? Well, without reading the entire chapter, I don't remember which one I was looking at. So we'll skip that. But look in Revelation chapter 21. In Revelation chapter 21, we see heaven described as a place where God is the light. There's no need for light. There's no need for the sun. There's no need for the moon, because we have the Lord as our light, God as our light. Chapter 21, verses 23 and 24. He says, and the city has no need of the sun or the moon to shine on it, for the glory of God has illumined it, and its lamp is the Lamb. The nations will walk by its light, and the kings of the earth will bring their glory into it, speaking of the heaven and the eternal realm. And then in chapter 22 and in verse 5, we read this, there will no longer be any night, and they will not have any need of the light of a lamp, nor the light of the sun, because the Lord God will illumine them, and they will reign forever and ever. And so we have this light waiting for us, this great moral light, spiritual light, that will shine in a way that overpowers everything. There will be no darkness. There will be no sin. There will no, in other passages, no sorrow in that place where there is a light. And so we are reflections of that light. Jesus shines to us. We are the lens through which the light of Christ shines into the world. Well, there could be a lot more said about that. And we'll save it for next Sunday night with part two of Why the Church is a Beacon. Let's just wrap up with some final thoughts. Go ahead and get your songbook out. So, invitation song number 278. Let's go ahead and get that out. The darkness surrounds us. Are you giving in to the dark, hiding in and from the dark because of fear? Or are you stirred up by Christ in your life to be his light? When you think about it, a plankton, I didn't get a picture of a plankton, but you can imagine how many millions of plankton there had to be for a trail like that to show up. That's a military ship in the Indian Ocean, by the way. There had to be millions of plankton for that light, for that trail to show. One individual plankton is insignificant, right? One little plankton is nothing. And in some ways, we need to think of ourselves that we're one little plankton. Each one of us individually is one little plankton. And we don't have much light. But when we mix with all the plankton here, our light begins to glow, the power that light begins to show. And then when we compound that with all the Christians across this country, the light of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the light of our Lord, begins to shine brightly. And we can have the power to change lives. And that's how we're going to deal with our culture. Not politically, not the power of this world. That's not the way you deal with it. That's not the way Christians deal with sin. They deal with it through the gospel. And we'll talk about that more next week. I just got one final question. Will you be a part of the church's beacon leading the lost to safety in Jesus? That requires you to be a Christian. Because if you're not a Christian, you're in the darkness. But if you're a Christian, you're a plankton. You're one of those little plankton in the middle of all of that light, leading people to Christ. Which will you be? If you're not a Christian, let us help you become one tonight. If you are one and you've let your light go out, and you need some encouragement, you need some uplifting, you need someone to put an arm around your shoulder and hold you up and say, come on, you can do that, let your light shine. There are people here in this building that will help you do that tonight. If we can help you be right with God in any way, whatever it may be, please come while we stand and while we sing.